Welcome to the Freedom Line, the podcast for the Center for Individual Freedom, where we meet nonsense with common sense. Here's your host, Renee Giacchino.
Into the Freedom Cast, my name is Renee Giacchino. I'm Corporate Counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom. Joining me again is Phil Kirpin. Phil serves as President of American Commitment. You can follow Phil and the work of his organization by going to his website at www.americancommitment.org. That's americancommitment.org. Phil, it's always a pleasure to have you with me. Thanks so much for joining me again. I appreciate it.
Oh, of course. The pleasure is mine.
So let's start with some hot off the press. I did not line you up for this interview to talk about this, but it certainly is very timely. The Democratic Party, or certainly the Democratic nominee, has selected her vice president. Give us your thoughts. What have you heard there inside the Beltway?
Well, essentially, the Democratic Party sided with their most left-wing faction, their most progressive faction, by going for the candidate who was endorsed and pushed for the role by Bernie Sanders, and who is kind of on the left wing of every policy divide inside the Democratic Party. So this is a governor who adopted California car standards, who was on board with all of the gender craziness. I think he signed a bill ordering that all schools in the state have tampons in the boys' bathrooms. So that'll kind of tell you kind of the mindset and the wing of the party that he's coming from. He had a 38% increase in spending in his last budget, one budget, 38% increase in spending, about $10 billion in tax increases, and of course, kind of celebrated the riots when his state was burning. And I think his wife said something like she loved the smell of the burning tires because she knew what an important moment it was. I don't think most voters relate to that. And of course, you know, the other aspect of this is who he didn't choose, which is who she didn't choose, which is Josh Shapiro from Pennsylvania, who had been kind of seen as the favorite. And then a lot of the anti-Semites in the party objected to having a Jewish candidate on the ticket. And even left-wing commentator Anthony Van Jones was on CNN saying that it was anti-Semitic elements in the party that kind of knocked Shapiro out at the end, and she went in the direction of Walz. And I know I'm rambling on, but you know, he was also horrendous during COVID, one of the lockdown artists, one of the governors who had the must-admit nursing home order like Cuomo that led to very bad outcomes in the state's nursing homes. And he had the snitch line for people who violated his lockdowns to get ratted out by their neighbors. And maybe the most offensive to me, they had some of the longest school closures in the country in Minnesota. The Burbio data that tracked school closures said that they had Minnesota at only 47% in-person availability through the 2020-2021 school year, so less than half the time kids were in school. And then when he was up for his reelection, Tim Walz just lied about it pretty egregiously, said, oh, kids only missed 10 days of school in my state, which was insane. They missed, you know, 90 days of school. They missed half the school days on average, according to the best data we have. So he just completely lied, which I find pretty outrageous. And then the other thing that's been getting a lot of play today is his claims to being a veteran, and his great military record is being questioned by people who are in his National Guard unit, who say that he had two more years and he walked off the job. He quit to avoid being deployed to Iraq. And so we may see some of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth type attacks on him as well. So I think she chose to go with the hard left of her party, and maybe that makes political sense to kind of consolidate her base if they're concerned about, you know, base turnout. But it certainly is going to present a lot of problems, I think, with independent voters that they went in that direction.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, for forever I've heard a vice president, does it really matter? Does it matter who they pick for vice president? Does it matter? But I mean, if we look back 4 years, I mean, it certainly made a big difference
Renee,
in Biden's
Renee, we have a vice president basically running the country right now, right?
Everything
they put out of the White House says, you know, so-and-so briefed President Biden and Vice President Harris. I mean, they're acting like it's a co-presidency at the moment. And given what we know about Biden's cognitive functioning, she's sort of, you know, he's sort of technically the president, but she's kind of a quasi-president at the moment. So, yeah, I mean, we like to say vice presidents don't matter. We hope vice presidents don't matter, but, you know, sometimes they kind of end up taking over, so they do matter.
Well, and that's that raises another interesting, point that, I'm hearing rumblings about, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I'm sure you're hearing, much more again, as I said, being within the Beltway. But there are some folks who believe that President Biden is actually potentially going to step down before November so that she can be the acting president, because allegedly it may be easier for someone to be elected as an incumbent. Are you hearing that?
Some people have suggested it, but I'm actually hearing the opposite, that they don't want to do that for the simple reason that they're trying to walk this tightrope where they kind of admitted that he can't serve another four-year term, but they don't want to admit that he's incompetent to serve now, because if they admit that, it raises all these questions of the cover-up and, why she hadn't come forward earlier and invoked the 25th Amendment. So I think they want to sort of ride things out in the current arrangement and continue to pretend that he's perfectly fine now. He just, didn't think he could serve another 4 years. And you'll notice that the whole tone and tenor of the media and the Democratic criticisms of Biden changed completely once he withdrew as a candidate. And they are now praising him to the rafters. Nancy Pelosi saying he should be on Mount Rushmore. And they're not trying to push him out. They seem to be doing the opposite, in my opinion.
So again, coming back to the selection of Tim Walz as the vice presidential candidate, I think there are a lot of people that are saying, I've never even heard this person's name before. How did this come to be? What happened to some of the others? I mean, you definitely talked about Josh Shapiro, who I thought, a lot of us thought was going to be the front runner. What happened to folks like Gavin Newsom? And I mean, did they just choose to drop out? They don't want to be considered as a VP?
I think that a lot of the people in the Democratic Party who sort of think of themselves as future presidents, presidential contenders, would rather sit this out. They'd rather sit this out because it's at best a 50-50 proposition, and if you lose as part of a national ticket, it takes a lot of the it takes a lot of the shine off you as a presidential contender. And so I think people like Gretchen Whitmer and Gavin Newsom, there was more downside than upside, and so they very early on said they didn't want to be considered, and so they weren't even really on the vetting list. And the Democrats, other than a handful of people that sort of have that star potential, they have a pretty weak bench. There weren't a lot of choices, and it looked like it was probably going to be Shapiro. There was Mark Kelly from Arizona was kind of in the mix, and all these candidates had issues with some elements of the Democratic Party, and I think what they ultimately decided was, let's get one of the most left-wing governors, but who isn't that well-known, who can kind of be second fiddle, and then we can sort of make Kamala front and center. And so I think that's how they ended up with this. But it looks to me a little bit like this was sort of a panic choice, like they really were lining up for Shapiro, and then they just the pushback from certain elements of their party was too strong, and they kind of pivoted.
Well, let's pivot if we may. I had invited you on to talk about an op-ed piece that you recently co-authored. It ran in the Washington Examiner, entitled "End of Chevron Means It's Time for Congress to Step Up and Grab the Reins." Tell us about this piece and what's going on with the Reins Act, where things sit for now.
This is actually a pretty exciting article, because it was the lead House sponsor of the Reins Act, Kat Kamick, in the current Congress, who kind of her staff and my team had sort of got together and said, we need to do something together. We need to do something jointly, because we've been kind of the lead outside group pushing that bill for a while, and she's kind of the lead on the Hill now. So it was, we'd sort of talked earlier in the year about doing something jointly, and I said, let's do something after the Supreme Court decision, because there's going to be all of this, hooting and hollering and self-congratulations about we finally stopped Chevron deference. The agencies aren't just going to have unchecked power to more or less decide whatever they want the law to be. And I think we're going to need a reality check to kind of tell people, like, look, it's great that the agencies don't get to decide what the laws are anymore, but if Congress doesn't actually step up and take control and reassert itself, we're going to replace the unelected bureaucrats essentially with unelected lawyers and judges. And it's just going to be the courts that decide these things, which is better, I think, than the agencies, but it's not nearly as good as the people we actually vote for and who are supposed to make the important economic policy decisions voting on them. And so that's kind of what set the stage for this, and then the article came together, I think, pretty well. And we kind of make this point that, you know, let's seize on this opportunity. I mean, we agree now after 40 years that agencies shouldn't have been making all of these super important economic policy decisions for the country that they were making. Now let's have Congress step up and actually learn these issues with a sufficient degree of depth and specificity to where, you know, they can write the laws themselves and they can vote on the regulations and take responsibility for them, and we can have a functional system following our Constitution and with appropriate accountability come Election Day, rather than, you know, going from kind of the administrative state force branch, you know, into the courts as the decider of these things.
So how likely is it, do you think, that we will see any movement on this? I don't mean in general. I mean before we see what happens in November. I mean, is that, you know,
very, very little.
Car? Yeah.
Very, very little.
I mean, suspect we're not going to see much done, period, potentially.
Correct. And this bill, for people who are not familiar, and I do think we've talked about it before, but I'm sure some people
right.
are not familiar, the RAINS Act is... It's a very simple bill. It's one of the simplest bills you'll ever see, and it just says that any economically significant regulation, the agency that's proposing it has to send it to Congress for it to be voted on before it can take effect. So instead of agencies acting and then you see what the courts decide and that kind of, agencies would write the regulations they want, they'd make their case to Congress, and then there'd be votes on it. So we'd actually follow the... And of course, we know Congress can do dumb things, so we'd still get plenty of dumb regulations, but I think we'd get many fewer, and you'd be able to look up who voted for them and hold them accountable come election time. So it would be a major improvement. And we've passed this bill in the House, I think, 5 or 6 times now, including twice in the current Congress. It passed once standalone as H.R. 277, and then it passed once as part of the first version of the debt ceiling bill that was sort of the Republican marker. And then, unfortunately, it was negotiated out in the final deal that was done with the White House. So we've passed it twice in the House this Congress, probably a half dozen times over the last several Congresses. We've never even had a vote in the Senate, and we've only ever had one Democratic senator who supported it. That was Joe Manchin, who used to be a co-sponsor. He's not even a co-sponsor anymore, so we might be moving actually in the wrong direction in the Senate. And a lot of people have told me, well, you know, even if you could get a bill like that through the House and Senate, no president would sign it because they want the agencies to be able to do things without oversight from Congress, and it would kind of tie their hands a little bit. But, you know, we've found that Republican candidates for president, at least, get what an improvement this would be and understand they're not always going to be in power. And so we've got basically all of the major Republican candidates for president in writing to say that they would sign this, including President Trump, who said that both in 2016 and again this time. And so I do think if we could get it through the Senate and we had a President Trump, he would sign it, and there would be really a permanent sea change in terms of you know, bringing accountability and, you know, not just saying we're going to let this pass from the agencies to the courts, but saying it's going to be our elected officials who decide the important economic policy questions. But the Senate's going to be tough. I'll be honest, even in Republican Senates in the past, we haven't been able to get votes on this. But I do think that we made very important progress in this Congress, in that it passed not just by itself, which it had done many times before, but also as part of a debt ceiling package. And I think if we could get it on a debt ceiling or get it on one of the big government funding bills or so, one of the big tax bills, if we could do that with a Republican House and Senate, we could probably get it through to the president's desk. And so that's going to be the strategy in the next Congress if we do have, you know, Republican control.
Well, and I think that, you know, with the case dealing with the Chevron doctrine, I think it, you know, brought in a bright light on this issue of, you know, where should these decisions be made? And so, you know, as you said, you know, this saying, okay, these shouldn't be administrative decisions by the fourth branch of government, but yes, they should also not be made, you know, we should not be legislating from the bench either, as we like to say. So, you know, I again thank you for the wonderful work that you are doing, that American Commitment is doing on this issue, continuing to keep it at the forefront, which I think is going to be critically important, as you know, as you said, now and hopefully shortly after the election, we might be able to see some change be made in this to become, you know, again, an issue that Congress and more notably, as you've mentioned, the Senate will be ready to deal with. So, you know, we appreciate that you continue to, you know, carry the water on this issue and continue to educate people on the importance of it. Phil, before I let you go, what else have you got coming down the pipeline?
Well, you know, it's hard to get much policy work done in election year. So, you know, we're gonna kind of continue to look for these opportunities. Obviously, there's going to be spending debate in September and then probably punted into the lame duck session after the election. We're also trying to get them to have as few session days as possible, because under the current law, Congress can overturn regulations using the Congressional Review Act, but they can only look back 60 legislative days into the previous year. So we're hoping that'll stretch back as far as possible, and we can subject a lot of these things to votes to overturn. We're continuing to engage on a lot of these spending issues on things like the electric charging stations, which they've built 7 of, and the broadband subsidies, which as far as I know have connected a grand total of 0 households in the country for $40 billion. So we're just kind of weighing in on what's going on and educating citizens on our various issues. But in terms of legislative action, there's not much for the next month or so. They're actually on recess now.
Right. All right. Very good. Well, our guest has been Phil Kirpin, president of American Commitment. Again, to follow him, check him out at AmericanCommitment.org. Phil, it's always a pleasure to have you with me. I greatly appreciate your time and the hard work that you and the folks who work with you do. And so I thank you for your time again today.